Welcome to PPM Simplifies. This is a weekly podcast that will help you have a better understanding on environmental regulations and how they relate to your industry. In each episode, we'll talk with experts across various industries who will share their insights with you. This is PPM Simplifies. Hello, this is Todd Perry, and welcome to PPM Simplifies. I'm joined today by my fellow principal and friend, Mr. Zane Hood, out of our Birmingham office. Zane, how are you today?
Doing well, Todd. Good to see you.
Man, it's always good to visit with you. And we've got a cool topic today. We're going to talk about terminals. They're everywhere, and they're kind of hidden in plain sight, so to speak. Zane, what purpose do terminals serve?
That's a great question, Todd. I think the average person that just drives down the road and they pull up to a gas station, they fill the car up with gas, and they don't even think about what it takes to get that gasoline, put it in their car. It evades the average person. It really does. If you're driving down the interstate and you see a large tank or a whole group of large tanks, that's a pipeline terminal. That's the infrastructure that takes to get that from a refinery in Houston all the way up to the middle of Alabama or the middle of Arkansas. It's really amazing. They compress this refined fuels and they send it hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles through a pipeline, fills up a terminal tank. And then from there, it goes into the infrastructure of the terminal and it's loaded onto transport trucks and it's taken to a service station. And so it is very important to the infrastructure of our country. You know, you could see people panicking at times when they hear that the fuel is low. You know, they don't know what all it takes to get it to that point. So they're very important. And there's maritime facilities as well. Those are on the water, and barges bring fuel from different places around the country, around the world, from refineries. And it's offloaded at maritime facilities. Same process there into a terminal sat on the water.
And on that note, Zane, you think about terminals. I would guess our capacity, tens of millions of, and they may talk in barrels instead of gallons when they talk about terminals. But honestly, we have just enough storage. It's almost like just-in-time delivery. And there are times when we actually have more product refined than we have storage space. And that creates a problem too. So do we see many new terminals being built?
There aren't a lot being built. Okay. There, at times there do need to be more. Remember when we had a fuel crisis recently and the cost of oil went down. There was nowhere to put the oil that had been produced because no oil was being used. There weren't enough terminals. The cost of a barrel of oil for a few short days was negative for that reason. So we could use some more terminals in this country for sure.
And I guess maybe the more common thing you might see is an existing terminal adding additional storage tanks to their footprint to give them more capacity.
That's correct. They'll wedge the marketplace based on their demand, supply and demand. That's the way it works.
Hey, we love it. It's the best system in the world. That's for sure. So thinking about terminals, they obviously have a lot of areas they have to comply with to meet environmental compliance. So what are some areas for terminals that they have to meet environmental compliance?
Oh gosh. This podcast is what, 3 hours long today? Is that right?
Hey, tune in, everybody, grab a lunch. We're going for the long haul.
Yeah, exactly. No, Todd, I can just touch on a few things. I mean, you could talk on this all day long. You have air, water, and waste media. You know, terminals are regulated under the Clean Air Act. Most terminals are going to be minor sources or synthetic minor sources for their air permits, but they can be complicated and they're regulated at the state level. Generally, the state has autonomy, but the federal agency's always kind of hovering over and looking as well. Same with water permits. Generally, those are handled at the state level. So you've got NPDES permits. Most terminals have a general NPDES permit. Some of them have pretreatment permits and they have treatment processes and they discharge their treated waters to a POTW. Most often, though, it's a general permit that handles most of the water at the facility. Then there's SPCC regulations. That's a large federal regulation that's been around since the 70s when the Clean Water Act came out, as well as the Facility Response Plan. And EPA regulates those. There are some states like Louisiana that have a state law, but most states allow EPA to take the main role in SPCC regulations. So they're all over the charts. Then there's also risk management planning. A lot of terminals, they blend butane in their operations so that they can change the RVP of their fuel content and hedge markets and become more profitable and handle their, they handle their markets at different times of the year with different type products. And risk management planning requires a submission to EPA every 5 years. And that's another component where they're regulated. So it's very far reaching. They're one of the more heavily regulated industries out there. It's a heavy burden.
Well, and they're watched very closely. And you mentioned something, whenever a lot of people in the environmental profession, they think about bulk storage terminals. They think a lot about, you know, the SPCC plan, spill prevention, countermeasures and contingencies. I missed it, didn't I?
Spill prevention, control, and countermeasures.
There you go. I was close.
You were just
close.
Testing me, weren't you, Todd?
And then that was just, you know, just trying to feel my way. So what's a fine difference between an SPCC plan and an FRP facility response plan?
Well, a spill prevention, control, and countermeasures plan is really has your, it's for a smaller facility. If you're storing less than 1 million gallons, then you can have a SPCC plan, and it really handles everything exactly like the name implies. You have a prevention plan in place. You're prepared when you have a release, and you want to have countermeasures. So you're going to contain a release on site. But a facility response plan is when your facility has what's called substantial harm. It meets that criteria of being able to create substantial harm if it overcomes its secondary containment or if there's a massive release. There's a big difference between a 30,000 gallon tank that loses its content and 1.5 million gallon tank that loses its contents. So FRP is much more robust and requires that you have routine drills. Some of them are physical in nature where you actually have contractors come to the facility. You have agencies come to the facility. Some are unannounced, some are announced. And then you also have what's called tabletop drills, where you're not actually bringing equipment out, but you sit around a table and you give a mock scenario and you go through a training process to determine how you would respond in the event that that scenario took place.
And you know, and that helps keep everyone sharp, you know, and again, this is a little bit deeper, but on the exploration side, E&P side, when Deepwater Horizon occurred, as they looked at their response plans and their SPCC plans, all their plans talked about things that were not indigenous to the Gulf, polar bears and Arctic tundra, and it was a boilerplate. And I remember hearing, and I think there were charges pressed against this guy as a rogue engineer out of Oklahoma that was flying around writing anybody an SPCC plan for $1,000, but the plan was wasn't worth the paper it was written on, because an SPCC plan or an FRP plan, which is, as you said, a lot more sophisticated, it's really important, and you should work off of it, train off of it when you do health and safety moments and drills. That those documents are very valuable to that process. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can really get stuck in the regulatory weeds when you prepare these plans and not step back and really look at the big picture as to what actually has to take place at a facility in the event of a big release. I had a customer one time that had a facility that had a templated plan. Okay. It was templated. It was off the shelf, and didn't consider site specifics. We got in there and looked at that, and we looked at the topography of the facility, and they had a spill going out the north side of the facility towards a river, when it in fact went out the south side through a trailer park, through a wetland, and into a situation that was much tougher. And so we had to plan for that and produce that in the plan.
Yeah, that's what I think about. Well, I think that's a really good segue. So thinking about environmental compliance done right at terminals, very complicated topic. But what are some areas where you see some of the most common violations or maybe some of the things to really pay attention to help make sure you are in compliance? What are some common violations?
Gosh, again, I think we need another 3 hours, Todd. it can be all over the charts. Yeah, so... you know, it depends which agency has got primacy. You know, EPA is very intermittent. They will pop up in different areas of the country. They'll do SPCC inspections. They'll look to see that you have your inspection forms in place, that you've done your integrity testing at your facility in accordance with the industry standard. They also will come in. It'll be a completely different group, and they'll evaluate compliance with your air permit. They may look at a certain segment of your permit. Like there's a subpart called 6B that's all about fugitive emissions at a facility. They'll come in with a FLIR camera. Recently, we've seen EPA doing that, putting a FLIR camera, which uses infrared lights and infrared sensors to detect volatile emissions at a facility. And when they see that, they'll see fugitive emissions and write you a citation or ask for your response or ask for other management practices to be put in place. So it can be all over the charts. Another one would be their NPDES permits. They're going to be sampling their stormwater outfalls. And sometimes facilities have a hard time meeting the limitations of those samples. And when they do, they have to submit a violation. They have to self-report, and they can get a violation for that.
Well, that, and you know, obviously those are some areas that you have to pay attention to, and we can see clients miss the mark on those. So when you think about that, on the other side of the coin, what are some of the best practices you've seen? What can, you know, a terminal owner to help ensure they're in compliance? Are there some best practices, tips you'd give our listening audience?
Well, I would say it's just like any business. There needs to be measures of accountability in place. And different companies have different levels of sophistication in their environmental health and safety programs. Some of them do the vast majority of it internally, and they have a consultant that they outsource for certain aspects. Others have very few EHS staff, and they have quite a few consultants or one consultant handling the bulk of it. Whichever way you do that, you need a tracking system. You need a compliance calendar in place that lines up all your permits, all your regulatory requirements, your deadlines, when they're due. It can reference different components of your permit that have reporting requirements. But a system of accountability in place that is kept current and up to date at all times so that you don't miss.
That's a great tip, and that really does help. And, you know, you think about it, it's just like everything, just a roadmap to environmental compliance that you can check and anyone can engage in and just say, hey, where do we stand and are we hitting our marks and when is this due?
That's right.
A great tool. Great tool. Well, Zane, this has been fantastic. Good visit. Just this is an appetizer. I bet we'll get to do a lot of follow-up conversations because these topics get extremely deep. If anyone in the audience wants to reach out to your eye, you know, get more information or have additional questions, the easiest way to catch us is our website, ppmco.com. There's a contact us button, and you'll have a form you can fill out for a follow-up inquiry, or there's phone numbers and emails to all of our offices. So this has been fantastic. Well, as we wrap this thing up, Zane, anything else you want to tell our fearless audience out there?
No, it's been good. I've enjoyed it, Todd. It's been fun. And I look forward to getting back together and covering more topics. We can do the other 2 hours and 50 minutes on the compliance piece later.
Well, we were blessed to have you, an amazingly talented engineer, principal environmental professional in the firm, Zane Hood out of our Birmingham, Alabama office. This has been fantastic. So as we wrap this session, our podcast up, thanks for tuning in and listening to us. This is Todd Perry. I hope you'll join us next time on PPM Simplifies. Thank you for finding our podcast. For more information, be sure to visit our website at ppmco.com. To stay updated on new episodes, feel free to subscribe to PPM Simplifies on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, this is PPM Simplifies.